For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Lawmakers are expected to return to the Capitol on Monday for Special Session 2.0. Governor Fallon set the date of December 18th, despite not having a final plan in place at the time on how to deal with the shortfall. Ryan, why do you think she called it so quickly?
You know, I'm not really sure. I feel like the level of political gamesmanship here that's going on is more amateurish than what we actually need. The governor, I think, was in a position where she had to call a special session after the veto. That was necessary. But as we got closer and closer to the holiday season towards the end of the year, it became increasingly difficult on legislators from both parties trying to figure out what they were going to do and how to plan for this. When she sets this for December 18th, you know, a week before the holidays, where most folks are going to be gone for the holidays, in the legislature at least, I think that she's upset a lot of people on both sides of the aisle. If there's something that everybody can agree on right now is that they're not happy with this and there's not a plan. So I don't really see what's going to be accomplished in this special session, at least on the 18th. Talking to some folks at the Capitol, there's a sense that they may just gavel in and gavel out. So don't break out the eggnog just yet. I don't think that we're going to see a lot of movement probably before the end of the year.
Neva.
I would agree. I think the question is, do we get some wild card scenario when they come back in next week, assuming it's on Monday? We've yet to see a time or right. the specifics of the call other than the date. And, you know, as you say, Ryan, I mean, the folks around the Capitol, there's the scenario, we'll come in, we'll gavel out, and that'll be it. The other scenario that seems to be kind of getting a little bit of traction is an attempt at an override that folks will come in, they will take care of that with ostensibly for the reason that there's some belief in some circles that the veto was not completely proper on the repealer, that that these agencies really aren't funded correctly right now in terms of what's going on, which just adds to the whole mess if any of that proves to be true and gets some traction. So, but if that were the case, I mean, literally the lawmakers could come in if the votes were there, they could take that action and go home, and then that would set the stage to buy some time for them to have ongoing conversations in January, setting up for the beginning of the regular session in February. So we'll see whether there's that kind of a twist and turn next week, or whether it's come and go. Because I don't think there's any grand bargain, even though there's all of this conversation out there swirling around. There doesn't seem to be any specifics that anybody's latching onto.
Ryan, is there a possibility they could override this veto? The president pro tem says no, but there are other ideas out there.
Well, and I think Neva's what she's suggesting is that the governor's veto, that she didn't use it properly. You know, that she vetoed some of the wrong sections and didn't veto some of the sections that needed to be vetoed, and that we've ended up in a situation where the agencies are operating with budgets that have not legally been approved by the legislature. And so, in that scenario, I think that you have a that necessitates the veto override. You know, that could put the pressure on the legislature to move forward with that. Otherwise, just a straight up up or down veto on whether or not they think the governor's actions vetoing the budget or not, or the portions of the budget that she did, were correct, I don't think that happens. But if there is some scenario where the veto wasn't exercised properly, and we've created some sort of legal and budget chaos on top of the budget chaos that we're already experiencing, then I think that conversation could get traction. But we're talking about a Capitol right now where, you know, during this last special session, we saw tempers and began to flare. You know, the intensity and the pressure at that place, it's like a pressure cooker. And now people are even more upset. And so you have people that are even in support of the governor, in support of the, you know, the House Democrats that were in support of some bargain. There's just the anger and the resentment, I think, is higher than it was even during that first special session. So the likelihood of them, especially in the House, getting to the 76 votes that they need to pass any sort of a budget seems even further away than it did a month ago.
A state house committee puts the pressure on members of the executive branch over financial mismanagement at the Department of Health. Lawmakers questioned Interim Health Commissioner Preston Dorflinger earlier this week, but most of the questioning circled around his previous job as the director of the Office of Management and Enterprise Services. Meanwhile, the Board of Health fired the agency's accountability director, Jay Holland. Neva, are we just scratching the surface here?
It appears that that's the case. When you look at it, when you have the commissioner, the deputy commissioner, the chief operating officer, the human resource director, the general counsel, another attorney, I mean, you basically have the whole upper echelon of the management structure in this agency that's gone. And all of these questions that I think lawmakers haven't even really scratched the surface, as you said, Michael. I mean, they really are trying to get into the weeds now of, you know, how did this happen? And the chronology, the timeline, certainly demonstrates that these conversations were going on back in the early fall, and probably some conversations in more sporadic terms were going back into last session. I mean, this is nothing new, unfortunately, but it is a big mess. Now we have furloughs. Now we have all of these other things that continue to unravel that make it a nightmare in terms of the financial picture. And I think the bottom line beyond that, like we've talked about with all of these agencies, when they're impacted, the services that they provide to the public are what are being impacted. I mean, when you just wholesale cut programs because you say you don't have enough money, but you're not curbing or changing what you're doing inside the agency, that's not going to play well with the public, and it certainly is. It's clearly in these investigative hearings not playing well with the legislators.
Ryan.
Yeah, well, it's certainly the case of, well, what did you know and when did you know it? That's really my takeaway from what we saw in this House Investigative Committee was this drilling into, did the governor's office know, when did they know that did they see these red flags? And they said that they saw some red flags in September whenever they saw some furlough notices that didn't match up with their idea of a balanced budget that they thought was happening over in the Department of Health. And then it was in October that they really, that the governor's office has, you know, previously said that they really saw the pieces begin to come apart at the Department of Health and moved Preston Dorflinger over there, and you begin to see the upper echelon being escorted out of the building. That seems to be a big question for the legislature right now. They want to know, I think, for a couple of reasons. One, going into that special session, did the governor's office know something about one of the largest state agencies that has hundreds of programs that are incredibly important to the people of Oklahoma? Did they know something about that agency and the troubles there going into the special session that they did not alert the legislature to, so that it may have impacted the legislature's work during the special session? I'll say that it's a little disingenuous, though, to say that if somebody wants to say, well, we didn't act on a budget because we didn't know something was happening at the Department of Health. Mm-hmm. That to me is a little disingenuous, because we have so many other crises facing the state of Oklahoma that the urgency to pass a budget was already there. Mm-hmm. But I do think that it would have been incumbent upon the governor's office to disclose if they even knew what was going on there.
Right. And that's the question, is whether somebody knew or didn't know, or when they knew it. It still doesn't change the fact that people in Oklahoma are suffering without this agency.
That's right. And it brings to really the key point that you have to have outstanding administrators and people that are above reproach, people that excel in their ability to manage large agencies, large numbers of employees, you know, tremendous millions and millions of dollars in budget, and do it effectively. And when you know that's not going on, I mean, then it's the domino effect. I mean, you have a board that has some oversight, and yet boards typically, I mean, I think most people would agree, while they're good, well-intentioned citizens freely giving their time and public service, they are relying on the people that are getting paid at the top to give them the correct information, give them the recommendations on what they should do, and typically they follow suit. I mean, they go along with what those recommendations are, rather than being probably as, you know, proactive as you might see a corporate board of directors at a Fortune 500 company that have a lot more have a lot more personal liability as the board. So I think it demonstrates that we've got systemically these problems that we continue to just kind of gloss over. I mean, in the early 2000s, health department was one of the places where we had all the ghost employees. I mean, we have agencies that continue to not pass muster on how they are functioning and operating. operating. And at some point, we've got to figure out how to correct that effectively.
Which just goes to the credibility of a well-run government, which unfortunately then the Republican Party can go, well, why should we even fund a government that's falling apart anyway?
Absolutely. There's this false narrative that state government is just rife with inefficiency and that's bloated, and that if we just trim down, that we can somehow pay for everything that we need to pay for and not raise revenue in the state of Oklahoma. That's just not the case. But whenever you see situations like this, it does fuel that narrative, and it gives folks like Representative Kevin Calvey and others that would rather spend the legislature's time auditing state agencies rather than coming up with a way to fund services for the people of Oklahoma. It gives them some ammunition.
But it's a two-way street. I mean, both sides of that street have to be addressed. I mean, it's a situation where clearly there are inefficiencies. Clearly there's mismanagement. Clearly there's probably corruption at some level in some of these agencies that very well may be uncovered. I mean, however that evolves. And beyond that, then you have the rub of how do you perform the duties prescribed? How do you provide the services that the people of Oklahoma expect and need and want? And that's where they've got to come to some order of trying to address both, not just address what the immediate problem is and letting the other side never be addressed.
Well, I agree with that, but it's too often a zero-sum game at the legislature. You find something that finds your narrative, and then you want to hold on to that. You want to dismiss
both sides
that.
Do that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Do that.
And I also want to say just real quick that this is a symptom of something that we've seen for years now. Because when we talk about mismanagement here, we haven't seen any evidence that folks are taking money, federal dollars or state dollars, and like going to the Cayman Islands or something. This is moving money from one program to the other to try to create the appearance that everything's okay whenever the house is really on fire. State agency directors for the last 10 years, even though we've been in the structural budget deficit for about a decade now, have been going in front of legislative panels trying to say we can make do with what we've got, and that simply hasn't been true. Now, this is the extreme of that, the far extreme of that, but it is this idea that that the budget crisis hasn't been as bad as it is. We've seen in the last 2 or 3 years, though, agency heads have come out and said, we have to do something, this guy's falling.
And I think the thing to remember is, I don't believe that we're dealing just with this in one agency. I think this is systemic of government, state government, broadly speaking. I think we will see, over time, a lot of these other agencies come under this same kind of real scrutiny and have, maybe, hopefully not to the degree we're talking about with the state health department, but have incredible problems that they're going to have to address at the top level.
Governor Fallon issues an executive order to crack down on sexual harassment in state government. It instructs state officials and agency directors to be proactive in training employees or on inappropriate behavior, among other things. Ryan, your thoughts on this executive order?
Yeah, I think that it's a good move. I applaud the governor for doing this, and we certainly have a problem in state government. We have a problem at the state legislature for sure. A recent report by the Oklahoman interviewed several female legislators, have heard from their experience. I've been at the legislature. I've seen that myself, and I know for a fact that it's not just among legislators. It's staff. It's lobbyists, and it's a culture that has to be checked. And I think that this executive order is a step towards that. But what I would really say is that the best way that we can combat sexual harassment at the state capitol is to put more women in office. The boys' club needs to end at the state legislature, and if we have more women in office, that's going to set a tone. And I think that we're seeing that. I think that around the country, we've seen in the wake of the Me Too movement, many, many women on both sides of the aisle stepping up and saying, "I'm going to run for office. Enough is enough. My voice, the voice of women, needs to be heard." And until we have that, I mean, right now we have a very small minority of women serving in the state legislature, and until we have that, and we have women in leadership positions, an increased number of women in leadership positions, I don't think we're going to see a real marked decrease in the amount of sexual harassment, sexual assault that we see.
Neva?
I would agree with those points, Ryan. I think the other thing is with the executive order, it instructed state officials and agency directors basically to be proactive in providing the training and these sorts of things. It really, really didn't address the legislative side of it, though, because they're kind of their own, just like Congress. They're their own police entity and bodies. And so, although I will say that as we all know, I mean, there have been issues and incidents ongoing in legislative circles, and I think that it is incumbent upon the upon them to be as aggressive in pursuing this as much as it is in the public sector as well as the private sector.
Well, and I think for a long time we existed in this environment where, whether it was a particular individual, be that a legislator, a lobbyist, or whomever, that there were well-known secrets. You know, everybody knew that this person did this, that this person was a harasser. They did, you know, borderline assault or did assault folks. And we've got a former state senator right now about to go to trial for sexual battery of an Uber driver. I think that, you know, these well-known secrets are going to start to come out of the woodworks, and it's going to be and hopefully more people are going to feel emboldened and have the support to come forward and take that stuff out of the shadows and shine a light on it.
And beyond just government, at large. I mean, yeah. For Oklahomans, wherever they are in the workplace and wherever they are in any part of the state. I mean, it doesn't have to be just in the metropolitan areas and in places that have more, where there's more focus, but it needs to be across the board. And I think this national backdrop, with all the conversations that now has been going on for weeks, puts it at the forefront in the minds of the average citizen, where they can now kind of understand and address this and know this and maybe have an opportunity to have things dealt with if they need to be at their level.
Yeah. Three people signed up to run for Oklahoma City mayor. Although it's a nonpartisan race, there are still obvious political sides, with Republican State Senator David Holt, Democrat Randall Smith, and independent OU student Taylor Neighbors. Neva, it looks like Holt should have this one without any problems.
It certainly will be a much different race than had some of the folks that had been
Brian
talked
Mon,
about,
who had to step
Brian
out,
Mon right. or Councilman Shadid or others that had looked at it early on. And you have, from the nonpartisan factor, I mean, you have the 21-year-old music student, Republican turned independent.
Taylor
you
Neighbors.
Have the you have yep. the independent turned Democrat. I think he's flip flopped three times. I think I read running, and clearly they have no constituency. They have no fundraising base. They have no real opportunity to mount a very aggressive campaign against David Holt with a $350,000 war chest already raised and 1,300 or 1,400 endorsers, many of them prominent names throughout the Oklahoma City community. So he's well positioned. He did what a smart candidate does. You get out early, you get very aggressive in your campaign to not only raise money but build support, and then it gives you the opportunity to be much more broad and inclusive as the campaign develops. I mean, there will be a campaign, there will be an election. Now, turnout will be a factor mm-hmm. because when people believe it's a foregone conclusion what the result's going to be, it becomes more difficult to get folks out. And, you know, as we can see any day watching any election across the country, you can be surprised. So, I mean, no election's final until the voters have gone to the polls and spoken. So, I don't believe David Holt's a guy that is going to underestimate the fact that he does have to get before the voters and show himself to be the person that wants to be their next mayor.
Still has to knock those doors. Holt is a Republican, yes, but he tends to be a little bit more on the moderate side, which would fits in the nonpartisan race.
Well, and, you know, Neva talked about the Democrat flipping from independent to Democrat, and then the Republican flipping from Republican to independent. You know, on those lines of partisan fluidity, we've got David Holt, who is a registered Republican, but oftentimes, if you look at his rhetoric, mm-hmm. is sometimes left of some of the Democratic legislators in the Oklahoma legislature, in particular Democrats from rural areas. I mean, he makes them look like they're further to the right than he is. And, you know, he's been running for mayor not just for a few months, he's been running for mayor for years. And so, you know, whenever Mayor Cornett decided to step down from that position and say that he wasn't going to be running for re-election and it became an open seat, David Holt had a campaign plan that he has been working for years that immediately went into action. You know, the endorsements weren't just from, you know, Republicans. They were from all across the political spectrum. Mm-hmm. And he made it a very difficult landscape for anybody that wanted to come into that race and give him a solid challenge. You know, Neva mentions turnout. I think that turnout is going to be somewhat of an issue. I think Holt's got this deal hands down. It's his to lose. know, there has to be, you know, there would have to be some, you know, monumental shakeup in this campaign.
Well, he already knows the job also as Mayor Cornett's former chief of staff.
Absolutely.
He knows the job.
And I think that's an important point because you now have Mayor Cornett, the longest tenured mayor in Oklahoma City history. So after this amount of years in office, to have the transition to a new mayor and have someone who clearly understands the office, intimately familiar with how municipal government works, and has a good understanding of government process in general. I mean, understands county government, which can be a key component to all of this, as well as having the relationships at the statewide level and at the legislature. I mean, he brings a lot to the table in terms of continuing to put Oklahoma City at the forefront of becoming, as we all talk about, a major league city.
Right. Well, and
well, he wrote the book.
Big League City.
He wrote the book on big league cities. So the other thing about turnout that I think is important to mention here is that even this race will have an impact even beyond just who becomes the next mayor, because if no one had run against David Holt and he had just won the mayoral position by acclamation, then what we would have done, it would have solidified the number of signatures you have to get an initiative petition passed or to get an initiative petition on the ballot before the city of Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. And those numbers right now are based on the numbers between the race between Ed Shadid and Mick Cornett,
which
is one of the largest turnouts in history for Oklahoma City. So that increases the number of signatures that you have to get by quite a bit. Now, by having this race right now, where it's probably going to be a much lower turnout race, it's going to reset that number to a much smaller number. And that's going to make it more likely that we see initiative petitions get the successful numbers that they need to
get
on the ballot.
And this will be a short time frame because the election will be February the 13th, and with not a likely prospect of a need for a runoff in April, I mean, this will be over very early next year.
Which means that that number will be reset, so the folks that had that education petition out there to increase income tax in Oklahoma City to pay for pay raises for Oklahoma City school teachers, that number is going to be a lot lower. Yeah. So that threshold will be reset, and if they decide to go back out, they're going to have an easier hurdle to jump over.
Former Oklahoma City Mayor Kirk Humphries comes under fire for comments made on a Sunday morning talk show where he compared homosexuals to pedophiles. He has since apologized for confusion over his comments, although he says he still opposes homosexuality. The controversy led OU students to call for Humphries to resign or get removed from the school's Board of Regents. Ryan, your thoughts?
He needs to go. I think that he needs to be out of the OU Board of Regents. I think that the corporations that have him on their board need to reconsider the kind of leadership that he's offering to their organizations, but in particular at the University of Oklahoma. Here's a guy that's going to step in. This is one of the least diverse boards of regents that you can look at. And you talk about the problems with diversity on that campus, everything from students to faculty to administration. You look at the regents, and I think that sets the tone. And now you're going to put a guy who on TV, on a Sunday morning show, made some of the most bigoted comments that I can imagine. And you have a large number of LGBTQ students at the University of Oklahoma, their allies, their loved ones, their families. And to compare them and who they are as individuals to pedophiles, to somehow say that the rampant amount of sexual harassment and sexual abuse and assault that we're seeing in our country right now is tied to homosexuality is just absolutely ridiculous. And this is the same guy that a few years ago said that Oklahoma City schools were failing because the better gene pool was moving out to the suburbs, to Edmond, to Moore. And what he was really saying is that white folks were moving out of the cities and that the city schools were straddled with African-American and Hispanic students. That's racist and ridiculous. And so this is a pattern. And he says that his remarks were confused. I really don't know how you confuse that. That's, to me, seems like he was saying what he really felt and what he really believed. And if you really believe that, you don't have a spot at the University of Oklahoma. Frankly, you shouldn't have a spot on Flashpoint. We have much smarter conservative commentators in the state of Oklahoma that could take that seat. Neva Hill. As long as she keeps doing this show.
Yeah. Neva.
Well, here's my take on the kind of this whole flurry around that. we have a show that's been on 20 years. You have commentators on both sides of the political spectrum. They make comments almost on a week in, week out basis that many people disagree with. I mean, on their political point of view, on their personal point of view on issues. In this particular instance, I mean, it is clear that the comments were made. I mean, by his own admission, he said that he regrets it, that they were not clear, that they were hurtful to people, and so he has tried to clarify that to the degree he can. That will not be accepted well among those that feel like it really doesn't resolve the comments that were made and the statements that were made. But the give and take back and forth in this particular setting, I think you have to say, are we going to allow people to state their personal points of view? Are they going to be able to make political statements that we know people are not always going to totally agree with? And I think that's maybe the broader issue than some of what you've talked about. Yes, a board, whether it's a board of regents, whether it's a corporate board, whether it's a school board, a charter school board, or anything else that a person serves on, if individuals in that community, institution feel like there needs to be a change, that is their prerogative to make that change or ask for something different to be done. But in terms of the political landscape, I think we have gotten things so heightened that we can't agree to disagree in a way that is proper, particularly in this particular context on this particular television show.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KLSU, its staff, or management.